Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
So, Matt, for the last couple days, I've been getting these phone calls where someone will call me, sneeze, and then hang up.
Well, that's weird.
Yeah, I'm getting real tired of these cold calls.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales.
All right, everybody, here we are again. Matt, how you doing tonight, brother?
I'm doing pretty good, man. How about you?
I could be better, but I could also be worse.
Yeah, we can always be worse.
The reason I chose the joke I did for this week is because, like I was telling you before we started, I may sneeze during the middle of recording this. The mountain cedar is wreaking havoc on the Ballinger household the last week or so. We are sneezing, and if we go outside, it gets worse. So any of our Texas listeners will understand the hellish conditions of mountain cedar season. But before I get off on a tangent of complaining about allergies, I'll say go over to patreon.com/graveyardtales, sign up to become a patron. We have several different levels. All of them we think are a good deal. We think for the price, you get a bunch of content. We have a whole back catalog of bonus episodes that all of our patrons get. Uh-huh. And then if you're a $5 or $10 a month patron, you get the weekly bonus episode. Plus, you get the audio and video ad-free versions of the main episode. And then our $10 a month gets all that. Plus, they get our second show, Side Quest, which is... it's one of those things, it's hard to describe. It's Matt and I hanging out, talking trash, trying to make the other one laugh or gross the other one out. It's basically, if you were hanging out with me and Matt and just sitting talking with us, it's the stuff we would talk about.
Oh, yeah.
And it has usually nothing to do with Graveyard Tales. So it's a good kind of release for me and Matt to do as a second show. But also go over and support our sponsors. If we have a sponsor on an episode, you can find their link in our show notes. You can find our discount code for them, and you can get you some cool stuff. Because Matt and I, we make it a point to not take every sponsor that comes our way. If we don't think it's a good product or we don't think you guys will like it, then we say no. So if we have a sponsor on our episodes, it means we genuinely like their product or their service.
Yep.
So check them out. We think you'll like them. Plus, if you get something from them with our code, it helps Matt and I out tremendously. But on that note, Matt, that's enough housekeeping and complaining about allergies. So why don't you tell us, what are we talking about tonight, brother?
Okay. So tonight we are going to talk about a body of water that the size of it is so incredible. It is so large. that people in ancient times could not consider that they were not looking at the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There was so little known about this body of water. It is 4.5 times the size of Lake Superior, which is the next world's largest body of water.
Yeah.
So even number two on this list is still 4.5 times smaller than this body of water. Yeah. The Greeks used to believe that east of their land was another strange country, and that was the end of the world. Mm-hmm. That was where all the land had ended, and on the other side was this body of water. So with history like that, you know there's got to be some pretty wild stuff that is associated with the Caspian Sea.
Oh, yeah.
So we're gonna dig into the history and the legends and a lot of the oddities about the world's largest body of water, the Caspian Sea.
Yep. And as we always say, go check our sources down in the bottom of the show notes. You can find where we found all this information. Everything we talk about is sourced and referenced there in the bottom of our show notes. So you can make sure we're telling you what that source says and we're not just making stuff up. But like Matt was saying, the Caspian Sea is known as the world's largest inland body of water. It lies between Europe and Central Asia, and it's bordered by Russia, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Iran, and Azerbaijan. Now, the Caspian Sea sits between the Caucasus Mountains on the west and the Central Asian steppe and deserts on the east. So it forms this major natural divide in Eurasia. Now, it covers about 244,200 square miles. So just think about how large that is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You can't. It makes it larger. I know. It makes it larger in area than all five northern Great Lakes combined.
Yeah.
So, like Matt was saying, four times larger than Superior, which is a superior lake, but it's just not as big as the Caspian Sea. Now, that's the reason I would say that they call it the Caspian Sea and not the Caspian Lake.
You're right. Yeah.
Caspian Lake just doesn't carry the same gravitas as Caspian Sea.
Well, true enough. I mean, it does not.
The surface of the Caspian Sea lies around 28 meters below global sea level. And the Caspian Sea is a closed system, making it slightly salty. The salinity is 1.2%, which is about one third of typical ocean water. So it's a brackish area of water there. The area is extremely rich in oil and gas, and the surrounding area has a very, very diverse climates and ecosystems and everything. But that makes sense when you think about how big the Caspian Sea is and how much area it covers. It's going to range in climates and ecosystems from one shore to the next.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, the basin it's in is usually divided into three parts. There's a very shallow northern Caspian, a deeper middle Caspian, and then a very deep southern Caspian. And it's separated by underwater thresholds, and I'm going to do my best to pronounce these.
Here we go. Such as
the Mangishlak and the Apsheron Banks. I don't think that was too terrible.
Nah.
You can comment and tell me how bad that was, how bad it sounded. But by then I'll know because I will have listened to myself a couple times while editing say that. So now the maximum depth reaches about 3,356 feet or 1,023 meters in the south with an average depth around 558 feet or 170 meters. Now, most of the water volume is stored in the central and southern basins of the Caspian Sea. Now, here's something probably not a lot of people know, and this part of it fascinates me, Matt. More than 100 rivers flow into it. Now, it's dominated by the Volga River. Around 80% of the river inflow is from this one river. But the Ural, the Terek, the Kura, and others flow into it as well. Now, while there's no natural surface outflow and water is lost mainly through evaporation, from what they say, but we also don't know for sure if there's not an underground outflow of water as well, which I would bet there is.
Probably.
If you've got 100 rivers flowing into this sea, it's still a finite bowl. So it doesn't matter how big it is, it's still a finite bowl. And my dumb brain says, well, there's not enough evaporation that would happen to keep it from flooding over the centuries if there was not some underground subsurface outflow. So I don't know. I just think there might be in one of the deeper parts that we haven't searched well, there could be an outflow there moving some of the water elsewhere.
Right.
Now, the northern Caspian experiences cold continental conditions, and it commonly freezes in the winter. But the southern and southwestern coast have much milder to subtropical climates. So it produces strong north-south environmental contrasts. And as we know, that can cause storm systems and crazy weather sometimes. Now, coasts range from low swampy deltas in the north, like the Volga River. The Volga Delta is especially swampy. And then you get to steeper mountain-backed shores along the western margin of it near the Caucasus. The sea contains dozens of mostly small islands, with larger ones. The Chechen, the Chulini, the Kulali, the Zilhoi, and others. Many serve as important bird and seal habitats. Now, geologically, the Caspian is a remnant of ancient Paratethys Sea that once stretched across much of Eurasia, becoming isolated during the Miocene and later evolving in today's enclosed basin that we know as the Caspian Sea. Over hundreds of thousands of years, it has repeatedly expanded and contracted, sometimes connecting intermittently with the Black Sea and the Aral Sea, leaving a complex record in coastal terraces and sediments. Now, the Caspian Sea hosts about 850 animal species in the water column and the seabed. Plus, there's more than 500 plant species that support the food webs around it. There's roughly 120 to 150 fish species that occur here, including a mix of marine-derived, brackish, and freshwater forms, many of them restricted to this basin. So they have basically, to put that in another way, there are fish species that are found other places, but in the Caspian Sea, they're slightly different because they have evolved to be able to deal with this slightly brackish water.
Right.
So if you put that same fish from, well, Lake Superior, and you dropped it off in the Caspian Sea, it wouldn't live, and vice versa, because they may be the same species, but they've adapted to their environment. Now, the Caspian seal is the only marine mammal in the sea, and it's fully endemic to this sea. It's listed as endangered after a catastrophic population decline over the last century. Now, there's reptiles around the shore that include the Caspian turtle, which is, they call it a freshwater terrapin. spur-thighed tortoises, horse-field tortoise in the drier steppe and semi-desert zones. But the iconic fish of the Caspian Sea, it includes six native sturgeons: the beluga, the Russian, the Persian, the starry, the sterlet, and the bastard ship sturgeon.
What a terrible name. All Dude, these other ones are okay, but this one.
I would be so mad if I was that sturgeon. I'm like, you gotta, somebody choose a different name for me, please.
Yeah, I wonder how many people know that, because, you know, there's a beluga whale, and I think a lot of people in the U.S. think when they hear beluga caviar, they think of the whale. It's not
right.
Whales, because whales right. don't lay eggs.
right.
I had this conversation with somebody I remember years ago, mm-hmm. and they were like, oh, it's caviar from beluga whale. I said, oh, they've discovered a whale that lays eggs. That's fantastic. yeah. I didn't know
That's
that.
That's amazing.
But yeah, you know, and what's amazing, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the sturgeon too, and some of my stuff, is these things are like, they are living fossils.
Sure. I mean, yeah.
They have adapted to their environment, but they are not that different from their prehistoric ancestors.
Right. Right.
And I mean, when you look at a sturgeon, you can see why.
It looks ancient.
I yeah. could show you a picture, like a drawing of a sturgeon, and tell you that this is an ancient dinosaur fish, and you'd believe mm-hmm. it. You know? Yeah. I mean, yeah. and they're still around.
And it was.
I mean, yeah. I mean, no. That's what, yeah. Lying. I could show you a modern picture and tell you yeah. it's ancient, but you're exactly right. You know, they were. You yep. know, they were prehistoric fish.
And they're actually pretty amazing to me. Not only are they ugly as sin, but they have the bony armor mm-hmm. along their mm-hmm. back
yeah.
that's actually under their skin a little bit. So it's a scale, but they don't have, like, if you catch a perch, they don't have the same scales as a perch does.
Right.
They've got these big bony,
like almost plates. Like plates. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy. Now let's talk a little bit about the people who live around the Caspian. There's five states that ring the Caspian: Russia, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Iran, and Azerbaijan. Now the Caucasus stretch on the western shore, and they add dozens of smaller peoples to this. And the nomadic and semi-nomadic steppe cultures have roamed between the Caspian and the interior plains for a long time. So that just adds even more people's groups that have lived around the Caspian. Humans have lived around the Caspian Basin since at least the lower Paleolithic, this says. Later cultures from Hyrcania, Parthia, and Khorasm, to medieval Persia, Turkic, and Russian empires layer their cities and fortresses along the shores. The name Caspian, from Caspian Sea, that actually comes from the ancient Caspians and the southwest of the southwestern shore, but nowadays this people's group has vanished, but called the Caspian Sea because of the Caspians that
That's
live
right.
there.
Yeah.
So real quick, to finish out my notes, let's look at two of the major groups that lived around the Caspian Sea and their contrasting beliefs. Now, the Hyrcanian world. Hyrcania, it lays along the southern Caspian coast, roughly in today's Gorgon and adjacent regions of Iran. They're famous in antiquity for dense, almost jungle-like forests, heavy rains, lots of game animals. And culturally, it belonged to the Iranian sphere under Archaemenid, the Parthian and Sasanian rule. I know I'm pronouncing those wrong. Forgive me.
I think you did pretty good, man.
Its elite followed the Zoroastrian religion, honoring Ahura Mazda, sacred fire and purity laws that included exposing corpses rather than burying them. So the landscape felt like a green edge of the empire. They said a human wooded fringe where imperial roads and frontier fortifications met this, quote, looming wall of the Caspian and the forested mountains behind it.
Ahura Mazda. I had a buddy in high school that drove one of those.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a terrible car. Terrible car.
Don't y'all love it when I make these terrible jokes, how Adam just completely glasses over them? He's just like, shut up. Yeah.
I figure if I give them too much credence, then the listeners will think I believe you.
Adam, you know, you and I, and doing this for as long as we have, you know, you can tell that we are learners. We mm-hmm. we love learning new stuff, and I dig it so much. It's why I love Masterclass.
Oh yeah.
I love learning more about a topic that interests me. And I may have just a surface knowledge, you know, just enough to be dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Masterclass lets me dig deeper into things that truly interest me. And I learn from experts in these fields. For example, right now, Atomic Habits. And talking about changing your life and how you do things, it is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
It's by the author, James Clear, who wrote the book of the same name, Atomic Habits. Get on there and take that masterclass. It can change how you go through your day. And I'll tell you, for me in the first of the year, I am knocking it out of the park right now.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And with Masterclass, you can learn from the best to become your best. With plans starting at $10 a month, billed annually, you get unlimited access to over 200 plus classes taught by the world's best business leaders, writers, chefs, and more. And you can turn your commute or workout into a classroom. With audio mode, you can listen to Masterclass lessons anytime, anywhere. And I love doing that when I'm on the road to go pick up Michael or drop him off at another art class or something. I'll do that and learn something while I'm sitting in traffic. And Masterclass fits right into your schedule. With thousands of short, easy to digest lessons, you can learn on your own time. And the classes really make a difference. 3 in 4 surveyed members feel inspired every time they watch Masterclass. And right now, our listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/graveyard, GRAVEYARD.
That's right. It's 15% off at masterclass.com/graveyard. masterclass.com/graveyard.
Now, the Caucasian Albanian, they lay on the western and northwestern Caspian shores, and it's what is now mainly Azerbaijan and parts of Dagestan. They had terrain running from coastal lowlands up into the sharp folds of the Eastern Caucasus. And its early religion was a local polytheism. So classical and later sources say that they had cults of the sun, moon, sky, and storm gods, along with strong nature worship. So before Zoroastrian and then Christian influences arrived. But over time, Albania became a Christian kingdom at the crossroads of Romania and Byzantines. Persians and later steppe peoples would add churches and monasteries on top of older shrines and fire temples. So how do they contrast? Well, Hyrcania was a humid lowland forest frontier, and it was bound tightly into Iranian imperial and Zoroastrian structures. And Albanian was more fractured highland lowland mosaic with a lot of tribes, languages, and competing religious currents. So Hyrcania's identity was relatively unified. marked by imperial roads, fortresses, and fire cults. And Albania was this plural kind of liminal place where sun and moon pagans, Zoroastrian clergy, and Christian bishops all claim the same valleys at different times. And you're probably asking yourself at this point, why are you talking about their religious beliefs? And
I know I was.
I was telling you before why. I think a lot of what Matt's going to talk about will tie into these different cultures' religious beliefs and how they dealt with or explained some of these things.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely. But you know, when you consider all the wildlife around and in the Caspian Sea, when you consider the types of people that inhabited this basin, it's not surprising that a place with all these natural wonders fed the imaginations of men. Mm-hmm. And that gave birth to so many strange legends and stories and myths and whatnot. Some, even now, believe that there is a creature living in the waters of the Caspian Sea. It is similar to the Loch Ness creature mm-hmm. myth. That creature is called the Runan Shah, or the King of Sea and Rivers. Like Adam said, there's like 100 rivers that feed into the Caspian. So,
yeah,
you know, a lot of inlets. But this creature has been witnessed over the centuries by fishermen along the southern shores. They describe it as an amphibious creature about 165 to 168 centimeters in length. That's not huge. And no. It makes me question that this was may have been a typo, but I couldn't verify any other way that this is actually supposed to be meters, centimeters. This is pretty small. It's yeah, not. It's a large creature.
I would say it's probably meters. You're yeah. probably right.
But the interesting thing is that it's mixed with human features. Okay. Mm. It has a large mouth, large eyes, and an earless head. And it's covered with black and green hair. It has webbed feet and hands that are equipped with claws. And the nose is like a dolphin's beak.
Hmm.
People believe that it swims accompanied by these large shoals of fish. And it produces these deep, throaty screams from time to time.
That's terrifying.
You know, and this is, you know, you can look at things like whales and dolphins that use echolocation and understand that ancient civilizations that would have experienced this had no idea that that's what it was coming from. So yeah. they believed it was either some, you know, sea-dwelling creature or a deity of some type. They didn't fully understand. But that sounds like what they assume that the Runan Shah does. And that may be how he calls these shoals of fish to them.
Yeah.
Now, the old myth came back into light around 2005. When the captain of an Azerbaijani crew told the press that they had witnessed the Runan Shah.
Hmm.
This quote says, that creature was swimming a parallel course near the boat for a long time, said Ghaffar Ghassanov to an Iranian newspaper. At the beginning, we thought it was a big fish, but then we spotted hair on the head of the monster, and his fins looked pretty strange. The front part of his body was equipped with arms. So they're looking at this is 2005, mind you. This is not some ancient tale.
Yeah, I mean, it's not 1405.
Yeah, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
you know, a fisherman actually believes that he saw the Runan Shah. And if you look up what the Runan Shah looks like, you know, it's funny because, like, the third image you get is the creature from the Black Lagoon with Runan Shah underneath it.
Yeah.
It's not far off. Make the nose a little bit longer and add some hair. And that's kind of what we're talking about. But the fact that he said it was a large fish, that kind of goes to the thing that centimeters was there was a typo. My bad. But it's not the only sea monster that has been associated with the Caspian Sea.
Mm-hmm.
As Adam talked about the sturgeon, the sick surgeon, you know, there's an orthopedist, there's like a dermatologist, and there, no.
Yeah.
There's six sturgeon, yeah. Six sturgeon.
Always a proctologist.
Sturgeon, always. But these six sturgeon species are found in the Caspian Sea, and the bulk of the world's remaining stock of wild sturgeon resources is in the Caspian, which accounts for between 80 and 90% of the world caviar production. And we talked about the living fossil, and we talked a little bit about their anatomy. I mean, they were swimming alongside dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, 200 million years ago, all the way back to the Jurassic period, these ancient armored fish, they are relics of prehistoric time. So, imagine you catch sight of one or more. Yeah. Of the sturgeon, which can get pretty large, and it does not look like all the other fish that you've been hauling in.
Mm-hmm.
This mm-hmm. does not look like a fish that I'm going to catch and eat. So automatically you kind of go to that. Doesn't belong. That is some kind of sea creature. Plus, they're long and slender, and sturgeon have been mistaken for sea monsters for centuries.
Yep. So your first thought is, let me grab it and squeeze the eggs out of it, and I'll eat that instead.
Yeah, why not? You know, actually, the first thought is, that thing is going to eat me, or maybe I should worship this thing.
Yeah.
Yep. Because if I don't, it's going to eat me.
Mm-hmm. If they were more plentiful, like if there were giant schools of these things, I could see them getting used to them
mm-hmm.
and saying, oh, they're a natural thing. But sturgeon are fairly small groups to loners.
Yeah.
So yeah. You wouldn't see like this big mass of them at one time.
Right.
And so you wouldn't say, oh, this is natural. You'd see one at a time, yeah. most likely. And you would think it was only one.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can see how that to ancient peoples could start a myth of a sea creature or something like that. Yeah. I do question sometimes if they wouldn't get used to it
mm-hmm.
and say, oh, this is natural. But then I go back to, well, we don't see them in big schools most of the time, unless yeah. you're scuba diving or something.
Well, they're not shoaling fish. So mm-hmm. they're not going to do that. And I would imagine over time, humans did become to get used to it and realize that it was a natural phenomenon. But that may have taken hundreds of years.
And by that time, the
legends are already there. Mm-hmm. You know, the legends are entrenched in the culture. So, you know, numerous legends about different types of sea monsters in the Caspian Sea. And a lot of people believe that it was, you know, one or more of these sturgeon that was actually being seen. Now, there's another sea monster that is associated with the Caspian Sea, but this one is not the natural type. The real life Caspian Sea monster was in fact the popular nickname given to an acranoplan, which was a seaplane that flew around 420 kilometers an hour, just a few meters above the water. Now, around 90 meters long, but with these little short stubby wings, it was the world's largest airplane when developed by the Soviet Navy in the mid-1960s. Hmm. And they called it the Caspian Sea Monster. Okay, that was the nickname. It could carry payloads of around 50% more of an equivalent size plane, but it used half the fuel. Now, the Ekrano plan was conceived by the idea that with the right configuration, a hydrofoil boat, which you know what a hydrofoil is, it runs on these little skis, could lift its foils out of the water altogether and just fly by using the lift effect of a cushion of air between the short wings and the surface of the water. So, you know, a hydrofoil is a boat that's on these little skis. Imagine that boat having little stubby wings, and then the skis, as it's going along the water, just kind of come out of the water. And the speed of it has created a cushion of air between the bottom of the plane and the top of the water. And now it's just flying right along. Okay. Mm-hmm. If you look at a picture of this thing, it is the craziest looking plane you've ever seen. Okay. From a military perspective, the benefit would have been that unlike a ship, it would have been safe from underwater torpedoes. But unlike conventional planes, it flew too low to be spotted on radar. Okay? So when the U.S. military caught wind of this, they were like, oh, this is bad. Okay? Mm-hmm. This is bad. And it was bad for a couple of reasons. One, it made us look like we were technologically behind the Soviet Union.
Right.
And number two, because if it was successful, it would give them an advantage, to be able to fly under the radar, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
They researched and worked on this thing for 15 years and never really worked beyond this area, and the final one actually crashed into the Caspian Sea and sunk, and it's probably still there. So it was, they were like, a lot of people could have mistaken this for a sea monster as the Russians were testing it. Maybe. It does look very bizarre. And if you saw it from a distance floating above the top of the water and you couldn't hear an engine, then, yeah, you might go, look at that giant sea monster out there. We're talking about the 1970s, though. So I don't know. But if you look up Caspian Sea Monster, this is what you're going to see. You're going to see this plane.
I just typed in Caspian Sea Monster, and I was given Caspian Sea Monster plane.
Yeah, right.
Were my two options. Yeah.
But I included that because I thought, that's fascinating. This is where they developed this thing.
It is a really weird looking.
Oh, it's plane. It's bizarre. It's bizarre. I've never seen anything like it. It looks like you asked a fourth grader to draw a battleship and put wings on it.
Yeah.
Kinda. Yeah. And when I say a fourth grader is because it's all kind of bubbly shaped, with these weird angles on it. Yeah. Really weird
thing. Angles are weird. The engines are weird.
Yeah. Yeah. Really strange. Another oddity about the Caspian Sea, and it goes along with some of the myths, is that the Caspian Sea supposedly has its own Atlantis, a city that disappeared within its waters. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of stories that refer to underwater cities, and some vestiges have been found by archaeologists. But the fabled city of Ithil, Ithil.
I like it.
Yeah.
You did good.
That's probably one of these cities. And this was a flourishing city built in the 9th century on the coast of northern Dagestan and was the capital of the Khazar Caganate. But the city just suddenly vanished. Now, Ithil echoes the story of Cybael Castle, whose remains lie under the water. The Cybaelis are mentioned in the Quran, and they were located in the land of Saba. How many times am I going to say Saba, Sabayi, Sabayil?
A lot.
Cybael Castle is the castle that is under the water. The Cybaelis are the people. Okay, and the land is Saba, if you're keeping score at home.
Isn't it fascinating, just as you were talking about this, what popped into my head, how many cultures have stories of lost cities that were lost to the water?
I know. It's crazy. And I mean,
like, we did the Japanese Atlantis. Mm-hmm. We haven't covered Atlantis yet, but we should.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder what happened, because we're finding that it's not just all legend. There are these cities that were in a part where they shouldn't have been.
I know. And what's so fascinating about these lost cities is there's so many of them that we have evidence of, mm-hmm. you know, that's the ocean just decided to take this one back, and it's happened multiple times. Now, we don't have evidence of what we believe would have been Atlantis.
Right.
But that's the one that
I have theories.
That's
though.
The one that we don't know. But we have the evidence of all these other ones. So the idea that Atlantis did exist and yeah. could have, I mean, people are like, oh, no way, a whole city sunk. I'm like,
there is.
There's other ones. It's yep. not alone. So yep. we know that the idea of there being a city of enlightenment, well, sure, there were tons of cities that were considered enlightened. Mm-hmm. But the fact that another city could have been taken back by the sea, we've got evidence of that happening too. So it stands to reason that Atlantis may not be as much of a myth as some people want to believe.
Right.
You know, I think the stories of Atlantis may have, you know, been embellished over the centuries.
Yeah.
But the fact that there could have been a city known as Atlantis that did sink is absolutely possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
sure.
The people, the Cybaelis were sun worshipers. And as the story goes, they disobeyed God, so their land was submerged by the waters. Now, Cybaeo Castle can also be linked to a story involving Alexander the Great. Now, the Macedonian king was willing to conquer a city with a splendid castle by the Caspian Sea. Unable to gain the consent of the inhabitants, Alexander sought the advice of Aristotle, who pointed out that the city and castle were built on a large rock over the city. Thus, a special liquid was made to dissolve the rock, resulting in flooding of the city. Now, let me explain this a little bit, because it sounds odd. Some of these ancient cities were actually below sea level.
Yeah.
And so the waters were held back, you know, by the rock. And if that rock went away, crumbled, or was dissolved by this magic liquid that Alexander the Great developed or had someone develop, the water would just rush into the lowlands and mm-hmm. cover everything. This is potentially
Caspian,
what happened.
We know the Caspian is below sea level anyway.
Correct.
So
that's what potentially happened to Cybaeo Castle. We don't know for sure. Yeah. But if Alexander the Great was going to take over, you know, a city and it was on the Caspian, it's possible that this is one and the same.
Mm-hmm. I want to know what that liquid is.
Right. It's like Game of Thrones, you know, like they make that crazy liquid fire stuff, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Just, you know, it's the sitting on the surface of the water, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that was actually real. I don't.
Yeah.
It's not a Game of Thrones invention. I think like the Phoenicians actually had something like that, you know?
I think you're right. Because there's something like that. And then the Roman concrete that would harden underwater and everything. And we wonder how they did it. Like, we still don't know exactly how Roman concrete was made.
Yeah.
We kind of do, but we don't for sure. So there was some alchemical knowledge that they had back then.
Absolutely.
So Alexander could have very easily had something made if they knew these alchemical techniques.
But another reason that there are these legends of lost cities in the Caspian is because of this geological appearance of ghost islands. And that definitely could play a role in how ancient civilizations would have perceived, you know, the huge Caspian Sea. Mm-hmm. Now, in 2023, okay, just a couple of years ago, just 25 kilometers off the eastern coast of Azerbaijan, a new island was born. But it wasn't just any island. It was formed by the eruption of a mud volcano. And very soon, it will have completely disappeared. You know, mud volcanoes shoot up instead of lava like a traditional volcano. These mud volcanoes shoot up rock and sediment and mud and gas, and they release it. And it goes to the surface, and it creates basically these mud islands.
Yep.
And they usually stick around for a few months or years, and then they gradually erode back into the sea.
Yep, until it happens again.
Now, this particular mud volcano is known as Kumani Bank. And there have been images captured by satellite. It has erupted enough material to form a ghost island in February of 2023. Over 300 mud volcanoes have been reported in eastern Azerbaijan and its waters. And the eruptions are very, very common. Kumani Bank having been documented as erupting at least 8 times previously, the first eruption being recorded all the way back in 1861. So we've got a recorded mud volcano eruption in 1861. Go back a little further. Let's jump back to 300 years or even further.
Yeah.
These mud volcanoes are erupting. You're a part of these ancient peoples. The sudden appearance of a new island must have been a bizarre occurrence.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine? You get up one day, what is going on out there? And next thing you know, there's a new island. Without understanding the source, I mean, it's reasonable to believe that these people must have imagined that some underwater god was at work,
Sure.
That, you know, they were giving us new land to explore, to develop, to cultivate, you know, not knowing that maybe in a few months or years, that brand new island was going to be gone.
Yep.
So if it sticks around for a few years, people go out there, they start to kind of inhabit it, you know, poke around, maybe build some structures on it. Maybe it sticks around long enough to build a small city. Maybe it's big enough. And then somebody goes, you know what? I didn't have oceanfront property when I moved out here, but I seem to be getting awful close to the water. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a few months go by. You know, I don't really have much of a yard anymore. I've kind of step out of my front door and I splash. You know, what?
I don't remember what's going, ankle deep water.
What's
in
going
my
on here? And then that small little city or encampment or whatever sinks back into the sea. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I feel like that is probably where a lot of these sunken cities, these legends come from.
Highly possible.
You know, because it's more than one. I mean, you know, the one major one, you know, Sabaul, we know because we have evidence underwater that castle existed. But all these other ones, you got to think, there's a really good chance that these mud volcanoes were responsible for this.
Yeah. Yep.
So let's talk about something else that's kind of fun about the Caspian Sea. The presence of lost treasure.
Mm.
Okay.
I love these things.
Yeah. Now, Stepan Timofeich Razin. I'm not going to say Razin. R-A-Z-I-N. I'd hate to think that this guy was named Razin.
Yeah, you're probably right with
it's Razin. Probably Razin. Anyway, he's also known by the name Stinka Razin. He's a stinker.
Yeah, that guy was a stinker.
He was. Let me tell you, he was a famous Cossack pirate who fought against the tyranny of Russian Tsar Alexis by pirating ships in the Caspian Sea. Now, because trade with Persia was very lucrative for Russia, they didn't take too kindly to piracy. Mm-hmm. And throughout the mid-1600s, Razin found great success in plundering ships, overcoming insurmountable odds against seasoned sailors and soldiers, giving him the allure of invincibility.
Hmm.
Now, in an attempt to capture Razin and put an end to this rebellion, Menidi Khan and 3,700 Persians attacked the Cossacks at sea. The Persian commander chained his ships together in an attempt to encircle and fire upon the smaller, lower Cossack vessels. So imagine you've got these big ships. They chain them all together so they can make almost an encircling these small Cossack pirate ships. Okay.
Yeah, so, flotilla.
Yeah, we got you surrounded. And now they're going to just fire on them. Okay. And you say, well, this is it. This is it for Stinka Razin.
Mm-hmm. Uh-uh.
A lucky shot from the pirates ignited the magazine of the Persians' flagship. And when that vessel exploded, all but three of their ships sank because they were all chained together.
Oh, wow.
So many Persians lost their lives, and the pirates took many prisoners, including the Khan's son.
Hmm.
So, I mean, once again, you know, they were thinking, we can't beat this guy. You know, how is he this lucky? How does he keep coming out victorious? He is overcoming, you know, odds that nobody should be able to survive. And he did it over and over and over again. That's what I said. He was a tremendously successful pirate. But ultimately, he wanted to lead the Cossacks to freedom from the Russian Tsar rule. So Razin would eventually get a little bold and lead an assault directly on Moscow with 200,000 of his followers. He was unsuccessful. But he did manage to escape with his brother. Now, fearing further retribution from the Tsar, Cossack elders decided, this guy's got to go. He's going to get us all killed. And so the elders decided that they were going to capture Razin, and they delivered him and his brother to Moscow, where Razin was interrogated, tortured, and ultimately executed in a unbelievably barbaric manner that I won't get into. But if you're interested and you like that kind of stuff, go look up the story of Stinka Razin and just see what they did to him.
Well, I'm going to have to. I'm writing that down.
Now, many, many treasure hunters have speculated that all of this hoard of riches that he managed to plunder from these Persian ships is somewhere out there in the Caspian Sea. Particularly around the Don River and the Volga River. Remember, Adam said these areas are pretty swampy. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of places to hide, a lot of places to hide treasure. So treasure hunters have speculated on where it could be. It has yet to be found. If it has been found, nobody has waved a flag and said, hey, we found it. It's over here. Which is probably the best thing to do if you're a treasure hunter, is to not go, I found it. Uh-huh. I mean, somebody's going to come take it away from you. But a lot of historians look at it and say, there's a really good chance because of the way the Cossacks lived, that a lot of the Razin's treasure probably went back to his people and to bring in, you know, more followers and to build them up as opposed to just make him rich. Yeah. Like I said, 200,000 followers, that was the ones that were willing to go attack Moscow. So there were many, many more, that were sure. either too old, too young, or unable, you know, to fight. And, you know, they held back. So a lot of folks believe that, you know, yeah, he had all this treasure, but he spent it, you know, on his people. And, you know, he wasn't necessarily just living in some gilded castle on the other side of the Caspian. So it's unlikely that it's there.
I still like the stories of lost treasure, lost pirate treasure.
Yeah.
Any of those stories.
Oh, yeah.
I don't care which pirate it is, but you tell me, here's the story of this lost pirate treasure, I'm going to look into
it. Yeah, exactly.
Because it's cool.
And my thought on it is, and I would imagine that's true for most of these treasure hunters, is we're not looking for all of it. We're just looking for some of it.
Yeah.
You know, they couldn't have gotten rid of all of it. You know, yeah, there's got to be some of it. I mean, you think, well, you know, we uncover a chest that's full of gold and jewels and whatnot, artifacts even. You know, its value is going to be, you know, astronomical. Yeah. You know, not just monetarily, but historically. I mean, you know, so.
We know it happens because people have found
exactly
like Spanish galleons
exactly
that sank and stuff.
Exactly. So, you know. People still kind of look and they try to decipher from, you know, all the stories and the logs and whatnot, where some of this might actually be, but it's all centered around the Caspian Sea.
That's cool.
Now, we talked about how the Caspian developed. You know, it was at one point it was part of the Black Sea, and that, you know, it's been a part of it and then not, and then a part of it again, you know, so, and then the fact that it sits below sea level causes some, you know, geological oddities. Mm-hmm. So the recession of the Caspian shoreline at one point revealed a strip of land that was developed between the 9th and 15th centuries. This was the site of what was known as the Old City, which was the historical inner portion of Baku, which is the capital city of Azerbaijan. Now, there is a 12th century monument in the Old City known as the Maiden Tower. It has served as the source for so many legends and folklore that's associated with the Caspian Sea. It's really a unique structure, especially to be considered when it was built, you know, in the 12th century. But the mystery of it is we don't really know who built it, and we don't really know why they called it the Maiden Tower.
Yeah.
But there is a legend as to why it is called the Maiden Tower. So this is a legend. It's pretty cool. This is a long time ago. There existed the ancient town fortress of Baku. The fortress had a fire temple tower. Remember, Adam talked about these, you know, fire worshiping people. This, you know, there was a temple that had this huge flame that sat atop of it.
Mm-hmm.
At one point in Baku's history, the enemy managed to encircle the fortress. The enemy demanded that the people of Baku surrender, but they refused. Consequently, the enemy launched a siege to demolish the fortress and capture all the inhabitants as slaves. As a result, many defenders of the fortress died while attempting to stop the enemy's attacks. The enemy's commander ordered the water supply lines cut in an attempt to drive the fortress's defenders into submission. Everybody in the fortress was thirsty. They had no water nor food, only blood and death. The supreme magi, together with other priests, prayed to the holy fire kept in the fortress's fire temple tower, asking the god Ahura Mazda to help and protect the people. They prayed day and night, asking the almighty and merciful Ahura Mazda to save their lives and push the enemy back. Finally, the supreme god Ahura Mazda heard the magi and people's prayers. One day, people saw a large piece of the holy fire falling from the top of the fire temple tower. A beautiful girl came up from the fire. She had long fire-colored hair. The crowd went down on their knees and started to pray to her. The girl said, "Don't be afraid. I am here to help and protect you. Give me a sword and helmet. The enemy must not see my fire-colored hair. Open the fortress gate." Meanwhile, the enemy commander was waiting outside for a one-on-one fight with the fortress hero. If the fortress hero were to win the fight, the enemy's army would retreat. But if the enemy commander were to win, the fortress would be destroyed and the surviving inhabitants would be enslaved. The fortress gate opened and the enemy commander saw the fortress's hero was coming to fight. A heavy battle began. In one of the God-blessed moments that ensued, the fortress hero unhorsed the enemy and put a sword directly at his neck. The enemy screamed, "I love this. Oh, you win. You win. Yeah. Who are you? Take your helmet off. I want to see your face, hero." She took off the helmet, and he saw that the fortress hero was a beautiful girl with long fire-colored hair. He exclaimed, "You are a girl. You are brave and beautiful. You are a brave and beautiful girl. If the girls of Baku are so brave, I will never capture your fortress. Do not kill me." He immediately fell in love with her because of her beauty and bravery and asked her to marry him. And the legend says, of course, the girl did not kill him, fell in love with him because of his open heart. Ultimately, the enemy did not capture the Baku fortress, and the locals named it the Maiden Tower. Pretty good story.
It is.
There's other versions of this story. There's other versions that say the fire-haired savior actually killed the enemy general, whom she loved, but she was so distraught that she killed him, she took her own life. That version sucks.
That's not a cool
But one. Since there is no true record of why the ancients called the structure the Maiden Tower, these legends serve as the story behind the name. But, you know, I think it goes to show the people that inhabited the area around the Caspian Sea, why there are so many legends and stories associated with this unique body of water is because the people that inhabited the area on all sides were very unique, very cultured, very different. in their backgrounds, you know, it just, it made for an incredible history. You know, maybe not so much paranormal, not so much supernatural, but definitely unique and fascinating all the same. And who knows? I mean, 20 years ago, somebody thought they saw, you know, the Ron and Shaw sea monster. I mean, how often do we get modern day sightings of an ancient creature? You know, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and, you know, the legends of an area, I think you said it, it's not even, you know, it's not paranormal or whatever. I think the legends of an area or of a place, you know, building or whatever, are the backbone of what you and I do.
Exactly. Yeah.
The legends kind of breed everything else, or they come from everything else. And if you look into the Caspian Sea, there is a bunch of legends, bunch of stuff from the different peoples, the different cultures and everything. And they all kind of, like the sea monsters and stuff, they all kind of, they seem to have a common thread. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder, it's like you and I have said before, there's always a point of truth within the legends. Mm-hmm. So what was it? Was there at one point an animal that lived in the Caspian that started some of these legends of the monsters that maybe doesn't live there anymore? I don't know. I'm fascinated with these different cultures that all have a similar, like, sea monster legend. Mm-hmm. But you know me, I'm obsessed with cryptozoology. Yeah. So I want to think that there was something mm-hmm. that started all these legends more than a sturgeon.
Oh, yeah, you right.
I can see a sturgeon doing it, but I would like to think that there is or was something living in the Caspian that began these, the folklore of the sea monster.
Well, I'll tell you this. You certainly think that a fisherman in the Caspian Sea in 2005 would know what a sturgeon looks like and would be able to identify it. I mean, certainly when you consider the caviar industry, and that's where it comes mm-hmm. from. So yeah. I can't imagine a professional fisherman mistaking a sturgeon for something right. that had arms.
Right.
That
right.
had hair. You know, so, you know, just looking at that one eyewitness statement, you got to believe that he saw something. He saw something mm-hmm. that he had never seen before. And it just yeah. so happened that there's an ancient legend about what he saw.
Yeah. You would think by that time, he would know a sturgeon.
Sure.
He wouldn't get confused by a sturgeon.
If not him, other fishermen on his ship would have right. known it.
Right. And he wouldn't be confused by a seal, mm-hmm. the Caspian seal. Right. Thinking it had hair because they lived there.
Right. People had seen them already.
You know he's seen them. Yeah. Yeah. So there had to have been something.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe a mermaid? Yep. You think there was a Caspian mermaid?
Look, you can believe anything at this point. But, look at this. I mean, disappearing islands, sunken cities, sea monsters, you know, these incredible battles with supernatural heroes, lost treasure, you know, one of the most prolific pirates in history that you've never heard of. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. So I'm with Adam. I mean, there is a thread of commonality through all this, is like, is there something that's unique, mystical about the waters of the Caspian Sea? I mean, it is not like any other place. I mean, there's, right. you know, it is so much larger than any other inland body of water on the planet. And the way it formed was so unique that maybe there is something to it. You know, maybe mm-hmm. it's there to house all of these oddities, you know, and over the centuries, we're now reading the stories that, you know, that these ancient civilizations experienced. So who knows, yeah. but it is truly fascinating. But what do you guys think? You know, is this just, you know, another tales from the sea, you know, kind of thing, mm-hmm. you know, that everybody that's been out on the water for any length of time comes back with some strange story. You know, is it one of those things? Or is there something more to it? Let us know. And one of the best places to do that is in our Facebook group. It's called The Graveyard. You can go on and search it. We've got thousands of members in there sharing stories, you know, asking questions about things, talking about the show, talking about personal experiences. And we love all of you guys. And we appreciate you guys taking the time to share your jokes and all that stuff. Nobody's going to call you a nut job. We all just want to hear these cool stories.
Yep.
Don't forget to check out our website, which is graveyardpodcast.com. And there you can find links to purchase Graveyard Tales merchandise. There's a lot of cool stuff in our merch store. And look, mm-hmm. Adam and I don't really see anything, you know, from this. No. Okay. So you pick up your Graveyard Tales coffee mug, your t-shirt, whatever. Really what you're doing is you're helping share the show when somebody goes, "What's Graveyard Tales?" You can tell them, you know, "Hey, go check these guys out. You know, they enjoy doing this. They have a lot of fun. They're just like us. They're just having these conversations about weird stuff." You know, it's a good way to share the show. And remember, this year we're asking everybody, share Graveyard Tales with friends, with family, with, you know, the idiot in the office next to you. You know, hey, share it with them. Okay. It helps us grow and we sincerely appreciate it. But on our website, you can also become a patron, and the folks that have donated to the show, we can't thank you enough. I mean, you're the reason that we've been doing this for 8 years, and you'll be the reason we do it for 8 more. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. It makes Adam and I feel good, but really it brings us up the charts. It makes it easier for people to find the show, and it just brings more people into the graveyard, which is really what we want. So until next time, we'll save you a seat in the graveyard.
See you soon.